Arsenal for Democracy is freely available weekly at arsenalfordemocracy.com or Apple and Stitcher, and we're supported by some listeners at patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy for $3 a month. The show is recorded and produced by me, Bill Humphrey, in Newton, Massachusetts. Our theme music is produced by Stuntbird. Follow us on Facebook or at AFD Radio on Twitter. The show is not affiliated with any campaign committee, and each participant's opinions are their own.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 394, recorded on Sunday, August 29th, 2021. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line from Idaho, as always, is Rachel. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Bill.
So, Rachel, as it is the end of August in 2021, and we're looking back on the centennial events of August of 1921 again in this episode, what are we going to be talking about this week?
This week, we are marking the 100th anniversary of the Battle of Blair Mountain, which is the largest labor uprising in U.S. history and the largest armed uprising since the Civil War. This battle took place over August 25th through September 2nd, 1921, in Logan County, West Virginia. This battle saw 10,000 miners come together in solidarity to protest labor conditions and assert their right to unionize, and they were up against 3,000 lawmen and strikebreakers. And while many news outlets are marking this centennial, we are discussing not only the battle itself, but the conditions that led to this battle, such as the company towns that kept the miners in precarity. And we will also tie the struggle of the miners 100 years past to the struggle of American miners today, who have many of the same grievances and are seeking the same recognition of their right to organize. So first, let's start with some background. Miners in West Virginia were strictly non-union, and union membership was grounds for immediate termination. And since many miners lived in company towns, this meant a loss of housing as well as a loss of employment. And they were also paid in scrip that was only good in the company town, and they often worked using leased tools. So conditions were extremely precarious for the workers, and the stakes for daring to organize were too great. However, in the beginning of the 19-teens, there was a wave of unionizing and organizing. And the new president of the United Mine Workers came along in 1919, John L. Lewis, and he sought to unionize the West Virginia miners. He was under pressure to do so from rank-and-file members participating in the coal strikes of 1919, which we discussed in episode 333 last November. And he was also under pressure from mine owners of unionized mines who were being undercut by the non-union mines. So kind of fast forward to May of 1920, an event occurred called the Mattawan Massacre. It was a fight between newly unionized miners in an independent town in Mingo County, and they were up against the Baldwin Felts Detective Agency. Mother Jones, a huge figure in the mining history of West Virginia, and Frank Keeney, who was president of the local union district, had inspired 3,000 Mungo County miners to join the union. They were then fired. So the detectives from the Baldwin Felts Detective Agency were hired to evict the fired miners from a coal camp outside of Mattawan. They first evicted a mother and her children at gunpoint, which enraged the miners. Word quickly spread, and the police chief of Mattawan, Sid Hatfield, confronted the detectives and attempted to arrest them. Albert Felts of the Felts Detective Agency countered that he had a warrant for the chief of police's arrest. Mayor K. Bell Testerman declared Felts's warrant bogus, and a gunfight ensued. And there were 7 detectives killed and 3 townspeople killed. So the Mattawan Massacre was a demonstration of the fallibility of the Baldwin Felts Agency, and it galvanized the miners into joining the union. And during this time, tensions increased between the miners and the owners, with intermittent skirmishes occurring throughout the summer of 1920. Police Chief Hatfield and Mayor Testerman fueled this mining resistance by converting Testerman's jewelry store into a gun shop and bringing guns into the area. In January 1921, Hatfield's trial for killing Albert Felts began. His legend grew, but the union was experiencing setbacks. the miners who joined the union were being replaced by non-union miners who signed yellow dog contracts, agreeing not to join a union. Mid-May 1921, union miners waged a battle against non-union mines. It was called the 3 Days Battle, and it ended in a declaration of martial law, and hundreds of miners were arrested. In August 1921, on August 1st, Hatfield was on trial for dynamiting a coal tipple, so he was engaging in acts of sabotage against the mines. At the courthouse, he and a friend named Ed Chambers were gunned down by Baldwin Felt's agents, just on the courthouse steps in full view of everyone, in front of their horrified wives. Word spread of the murder, and miners quickly gathered in protest. So about a week later, on August 7th, 1921, there was a rally in Charleston. Frank Keeney and another union leader, Fred Mooney, presented Governor Ephraim Morgan with a list of their demands, which was summarily rejected. The miners were angry and intended to march on Mingo County to release the arrested miners and end martial law there. In between Charleston and Mingo County was Blair Mountain in Logan County, and the sheriff there, Don Chafin. Chafin had already sent troopers to disarm miners in the area the prior week, but his men had been routed, and so they were starting to build their troops and munitions. Also on August 7th, 1921, Mother Jones held a rally to try to prevent the miners from marching from the capital to Mingo County, fearing a bloodbath in the fight between the miners and the Logan County deputies on the way. The miners basically accused her of losing her nerve and pretty much ignored her. So in the intervening weeks, all the way through August 20th and 24th, through the 24th, thousands of miners began converging on Blair Mountain. They even commandeered a Chesapeake and Ohio freight train. The union leaders Keeney and Mooney fled for Ohio, and another local United Mine Workers leader, Bill Blizzard, assumed leadership over the miners. Meanwhile, Sheriff Chafin started preparing his defenses, backed by the Logan County Coal Operators Association, and they created a private armed force of over 2,000 men. So that's kind of the background leading up to the Battle of Blair Mountain. And so now, Bill, can you kind of take us through the events in the battle?
Yes. So primarily, and I will mention when I'm citing other sources, but primarily my source for this narrative is going to be a new Smithsonian article from a few days ago, August 25th, 2021, marking the centennial. So I'm going to quote extensively from this. According to Chuck Keeney, historian and descendant of key labor leader Frank Keeney, the miners swore themselves to secrecy over who was leading them to avoid legal retaliation. This meant that no single general led the miner army, although they did think of themselves as an army and not just peaceful protesters. Keeney says they were rebelling against the mine guard system, but they were also avenging the death of their friend. While the miners may have been a ragtag group full of secrets, Keeney argues they were still well organized, as do historians who've recorded the history. In Thunder in the Mountains, a thoroughly reported historical account of the battle, author and historian Lon Savage describes a testy, oppressed, and angry group of laborers. They had been crushed and killed on their jobs and fired from them when they tried to organize a union, Savage wrote. They had been evicted from their company homes and machine-gunned in their union tents. Periodically, they had risen in a fury. On August 25th, 1921, it all boiled over, and miners marched toward Mingo, where they hoped to force local deputies to lift the strict martial law that inhibited union organizing. The two sides fought for days, shooting stray bullets back and forth in mountain passes on the march to Mingo. With gunfire being exchanged throughout the march and in wooded, sheltered areas, it was difficult to ascertain, and even now, how many men were shot or injured at any given time. Before and during Blair Mountain, Logan County Sheriff Don Chafin ruled the region and sided with local coal operators, hoping to put down the rebellion and restore order in his jurisdiction. He helped organize a raid on the town of Sharples on August 27th, when around 70 police officers fired at opposing miners. Two miners were killed, but as people ran from town to town, the rumored death toll grew like a big fish story. Savage wrote that miners told each other bodies were stacked up after the raid. Now, quoting from the History Channel website, by August 28th, some 10,000 Union men had massed near the border of Logan County and began trading gunfire with company supporters. To distinguish one another in the dense forest, many of the miners tied red handkerchiefs around their neck, and they soon became known as the Redneck Army. Quoting now from the National Park Service website, on the night of August 30th, John Wilburn, a minister and part-time miner, led a group of 70 miners, including two of his sons, up the mountain. During a dawn patrol, this is on the 31st, Wilburn and four other men encountered three of Chafin's deputy sheriffs, including John Gore, an infamous mine guard in Logan County. In the gun battle that ensued, the miners shot and wounded Gore, who then shot and killed miner Eli Kemp. Wilburn responded by shooting Gore in the head, ensuring that he was dead. For the next 3 days, the two sides battled with Gatling guns, rifles, and other firearms along the ridge of Blair Mountain. During the second day of fighting, Chafin ordered his men to fly airplanes over the encamped marchers and drop two nausea-inducing gas bombs and two bombs filled with gunpowder, nuts, and bolts. And I will note that this is the second time in 1921 that domestic aerial bombardment had occurred in the United States. And you can listen to our episode from May of this year, number 378, on Tulsa and the destruction of Black Wall Street for more information on that. Now, going back to the History Channel article, which, again, to recap, on August 31st, there was that deadly shootout, nighttime or dawn forest shootout between Pastor Wilburn and Deputy Sheriff Gore that resulted in some fatalities. Quoting now from the article, the main army of miners commenced a two-pronged assault on Chafin's trenches and breastworks. Scores of Union men streamed up the mountainside, but despite their superior numbers, they were repeatedly driven back by the defenders, who riddled them with machine gun fire from the high ground. The miners made more progress when the battle was renewed on September 1st. That morning, a detachment of Union men assaulted a spot called Craddock Fork with a Gatling gun looted from a coal company store. Not sure why they had a coal company store stocking a Gatling gun, but anyway. Logan forces fought back with a machine gun, but after 3 hours of heavy fire, their weapons jammed. The miners surged forward and briefly broke the defensive line, only to be repulsed by a fusillade of bullets from a second machine gun nest located further up the ridge. For the rest of the day, the hills and hollows echoed with gunfire as Union men repeatedly attacked the defenders' lines. Machine guns cracked up there, so you would think the whole place was coming down on you, miner Ira Wilson later recalled. At one point in the battle, the din also included the sound of falling bombs. Sheriff Chafin had chartered three private biplanes and equipped them with tear gas and pipe bombs loaded with nuts and bolts for shrapnel. The planes dropped the homemade explosives over two of the miners' strongholds but failed to inflict any casualties. In the end, the miners' siege of Blair Mountain ended only with the arrival of federal troops. A squadron of Army Air Service reconnaissance planes began patrolling the skies on September 1st, and by the following day, General Banholtz had mobilized some 2,100 Army troops on the orders of President Warren G. Harding. Scattered fighting continued between the miners and the Logan defenders until September 1st, but most of the men welcomed the government intervention and laid down their weapons. Basically, they thought that the federal government intervening meant that there was finally going to be some sort of external force that could counter the unfair pro-mining forces in the area, which obviously is not the case, but that's what they thought. Roughly 1,000 exhausted miners eventually surrendered to the army while the rest scattered and returned home. It was later estimated that some 1 million rounds had been fired during the battle. Reports of casualties ranged from as few as 20 killed to as many as 100, but the actual number has never been confirmed. And I would note here as well that it is interesting that this really is reminiscent of, at least on a small scale, so several World War One battles, and this was just a few years after World War One. The sheriff and his forces had really sort of dug in on the mountainside with various, like, multiple lines of trenches and things like that, and, you know, machine gun emplacements and all this stuff. Sort of like the situation in the Italian and Austrian Alps campaign. And just having the multiple defensive lines, I think, would have been familiar from anyone that had served on the Western Front and so forth up in France and Flanders. So it's interesting to see that being employed in the United States along with the airplanes, which I feel like the airplanes part of it, as noted there, obviously kind of shocking, but didn't really accomplish a whole lot. The airplanes, it wasn't very effective. People didn't necessarily know what to do to make, you know, more than just a disruption. That's the part that gets like a lot of attention, but I think it is worth noting how much sort of defensive construction had happened on the pro-mine side as well, And that's also sort of a World War One legacy for this period. So the clashes at Blair Mountain came to an end, as I said, with the federal intervention. Returning now to the Smithsonian piece, according to Keeney, the miners' doomed mission was the closest thing to a class war our country has ever seen. On September 2, 1921, President Warren G. Harding heeded West Virginia lawmakers' requests for federal troops. Their presence persuaded the miners to throw down their guns and surrender, as many were veterans themselves and refused to fight against their own government. They sought to wage war not against the United States, but against coal operators. Keeney says it's not clear what would have happened had the miners continued, but anything is possible. If they had continued to fight, they would have broken through, probably, says Keeney, who wrote a book about the labor uprising, Road to Blair Mountain. In an alternative history, a miner coalition could have overwhelmed the local police force and coal-employed fighters to push forward on the march to Mingo. There they might have lifted martial law, freed jailed coal miners, and made good on the popular miner's tune, "We'll hang Don Chafin from a sour apple tree." So let's talk a little bit about the aftermath, and then we're going to circle back to some of this point about what might have happened or the sort of extent and impact of the federal intervention. So in newsreel footage from the time, which is posted to YouTube and included in the Smithsonian article, you can see miners turning in guns to uniformed troops and uncovering weapons caches in the nearby hillsides. Quoting again from the Smithsonian article, "It's true that the miners didn't defeat Chafin and his deputized army. It's also true that they threw down their guns when federal troops were called in. But to many, they didn't exactly lose. By surrendering only to the federal government and not to the local authorities, they proved they were a force to be reckoned with. It was Uncle Sam did it," a miner yelled as he leaned out of a passing streetcar during the retreat. Savage wrote in his book that the miner expressed the pride of all that neither Sheriff Chafin nor West Virginia Governor Ephraim Morgan had stopped their march. Although pretty much everyone prosecuted for their involvement in the uprising got off the charges because it was so clear that all the juries across the state were sympathetic, the uprising was still largely viewed as a pattern of failure for the Union and Union efforts in the coal mining industry in general. Quote, "Membership in the United Mine Workers of America plummeted, continued strikes cost the UMWA millions and made little headway toward their goals of changing coal company policies. UMWA membership peaked around 1920, the year before this, with 50,000 members, but fell to just 600 in 1929. Later, it would rise and fall again, following a roller coaster of peaks and declines throughout the 20th century. And I would remind folks to check out our bonus episode number 383 on the Alabama coal strike of 1920, which had happened the year before these events. And we'll probably be releasing that episode publicly pretty soon. Now, Rachel, I know we've gone over the narrative at this point, but we wanted to kind of dig in a little bit further with some various angles of analysis on certain aspects that we've talked about so far today and have a little bit of a discussion about that. So could you get us started on that?
Yeah. So like I said earlier, there have been several articles or just Twitter threads about this centennial. And we found a few Twitter threads from historians or journalists that kind of looked at this event from some different angles that aren't really prominent in the news. So from 100 years ago news on Twitter, they highlighted the aspect that there were several World War One veterans. So here's a tweet from them. "The governor warns he'll call in federal troops to stop the march, but the miners are skilled riflemen, many of whom served in World War One and spoiling for a fight. It is time to lay down the Bible and take up the rifle," says one of their leaders, Baptist preacher John Wilburn. So they were armed to the teeth with military-issue Springfield rifles and shotguns, and they had arms training, which is kind of a different wrinkle into the typical minor labor uprising storyline. I don't know that we've seen an event in all the ones that we've talked about where there were so many trained veterans on the side of labor. So it's kind of interesting to see that. And another aspect is, like Bill mentioned, there were machine gun nests and trenches that Chafin and his supporters constructed around Blair Mountain. And that kind of echoes the fighting configurations that happened during World War One, and kind of helped the men on the side of the union owner or the mine owners in their fight, because they were at such reduced numbers compared to the miners. There were only 3,000 against 10,000 miners. So they kind of used that high ground advantage in a way that kind of showed their military training.
Yeah, and I think that as you said, one thing that differentiates this struggle from previous struggles is, like, in other sort of, you know, clashes at mines, you'd maybe see some dynamite-related sabotage, some, you know, a lot of people were trained in explosives in the mining industry, or you'd see some pistol shootouts or whatever. But this idea of sort of pitched battles between guys armed with military-issue rifles and Gatling guns and things like that, I mean, that's sort of taking it to a whole other level. And the scale that we're talking about is huge, right? I mean, you know, I doubt that they would have been able to raise 3,000 troops to support the mine owners without having that reserve pool of veterans and things like that. And similarly, to pull together, you know, 10,000 armed miners is a similar feat that I think is also unusual. Again, I don't know the exact percentage of people that had actually served in World War I, but it certainly seems to have had an influence here. So the other thing that I was wondering about, and I didn't find anything on this, but I'd be curious if anybody else can. So at the same time that this was happening, I think it's important to remember, although I don't know that there was any direct connection or sort of cross-pollination happening, that in 1920, 1921, the Irish War of Independence was happening against the United Kingdom. And this was an ongoing guerrilla uprising. I'm kind of assuming that people who were, and we're getting into the race dynamics in a moment, but I'm assuming that most of the sort of white local Appalachian miners here were probably Scots-Irish who were connected to Northern Irish Unionists more than they would have been to, like, Irish Republicans. But the IRA, the Irish Republican Army at the time, was sort of doing this campaign of endless series of deadly ambushes on Unionist and British police before they would sort of melt away into their hiding spots. And this goes back to the point about the sort of alternate history potential here. At the time, the United States, there was a big push to demobilize as much of the military as possible that had just been expanded briefly to pretty significant size as part of World War I. But generally, people, they wanted to demobilize the troops, bring them home, not have them continue serving. So the standing army size went back down and so forth. And there was just generally not an appetite for prolonged ongoing conflicts or occupations. This is actually one of the problems in terms of peacekeeping efforts in many parts of Europe, as a bunch of countries are breaking up and you have these sort of protracted ground wars happening between different ethnic factions and things like that. It's hard to get the Americans or the British or the French or whoever to go and maintain an occupying presence because there's such a big political push on the home front to demobilize so many troops. So you can imagine a sort of alternate history here where you have 2,000 federal troops show up and 10,000 miners say, no, you know what, we're not going to demobilize. And maybe they're not having a pitched battle of 10,000 sort of, you know, armed miners versus 2,000 trained troops and regular troops, because, of course, that would be more akin to what we talked about on our episode about the U.S. military interventions in communist Russia during the Russian Civil War, where you'd have then these, like, Bolshevik units that were kind of poorly armed and not that well trained in these protracted battles with American troops, and that didn't necessarily go very well for anybody really, but more it didn't go well for the Soviets. What we would probably expect to see here, had this continued rather than, you know, dissipating with the federal intervention, is probably something similar to what was happening in the Irish War of Independence, right? You would have had these sort of thousands of troops, thousands of armed miners active in the area waging a guerrilla campaign, you know, coming down out of the hills or, you know, out of the forest suddenly to, you know, pick off a bunch of police or federal troops and then fade away. And you might think to yourself, well, you know, surely the entire U.S. military would then descend on this and occupy it. And that's possible, but it's also possible that we would have seen something more similar to what happened in Ireland, which is that the general public and the government just gets kind of tired of the whole thing and tired of troops getting sniped and that kind of thing, and just decides to force some sort of concessions from the mine owners and things like that. That's another sort of potential outcome here. I don't think you'd have a situation necessarily like an independent West Virginia or anything like that, right? But some sort of a something that was a little bit more of a middle ground between those sort of outcomes. Also, I think there's some obvious parallels here to the raid on Harper's Ferry, which was also West Virginia. I mean, it was Virginia at the time, but what's now West Virginia. You know, the commandeering of a railroad train, the possibility of an armed clash with the federal troops and so forth. People just generally deciding they weren't going to wait around anymore. It was time to steel their nerves and do an uprising. I think there's some parallels there. So, Rachel, one of the things that I've alluded to a few minutes ago was the ethnic composition here, but we really haven't talked about it in any detail to this point so far. And in fact, this was not just a matter of white Appalachians that were participating in this, Scots-Irish or whatever. This was a sort of much more diverse group of people, sort of similar to what we saw in the Alabama strike in our episode on that in covering 1920. So could you tell us a little bit about the racial and ethnic dimensions of this particular uprising at Blair Mountain in 1921, 100 years ago?
Yeah. So there was a Twitter thread from Dr. Jesse Wilkerson from the University of West Virginia who kind of touched on this. So the thread starts, "The Battle of Blair Mountain and events surrounding it is incredibly important for understanding capital's power, labor, and racial capitalism in early 20th century, full stop. I don't know, however, that it's possible to write about it accurately without dealing with the major events or patterns in the region. Race riots and threats of race riots against black workers and businesses, disproportionate incarceration of black people in West Virginia then and since, the assaults on black women and children, the testimonies from black workers that they had to move carefully so as not to make white workers fear they were taking, quote unquote, their jobs, that the punishments for organizing alongside white men could be brutal. My question then is, what is the meaning of the Battle of Blair Mountain from the perspective of those black workers for whom the stakes were incredibly high? How did they join that battle to the linked struggles for black freedom and workers' rights? Why does the story so rarely begin from their perspective? What is the meaning when we start with them and their families, the complexity of relationships under Jim Crow?" There was a reply from Lou Martin, a labor historian also affiliated with the University of West Virginia. And he said, "For now, I'll note that Eli Kemp, an African-American, was the first miner to die on Blair Mountain." And he was mentioned in your narrative, Bill. But it wasn't really noted until just now. I was unaware that he was a black miner. So I think it's pretty interesting that there was a cross-racial organizing happening at this time, but I don't think it was quite, it's not the prominent narrative when we are discussing the Battle of Blair Mountain. Yeah, so it's kind of interesting that aspect of the organization is kind of pushed to the side because the stakes were so much higher for the black miners at that time. There were often really brutal punishments for black men trying to organize with white men.
Yeah, and as we talked about in episode 383 on the Alabama coal strike, this industry's unionization drives were unusually racially integrated, and the situation in West Virginia was the same. And of course, this was, as we talked about on that episode, a necessity, because if you didn't cross-racially organize, then it was very easy to deploy black workers against white workers against black workers, et cetera, to undercut this. There's also an immigrant component here. We'll mention that in passing in this section that I wanted to read from the Smithsonian article. But of course, as in most of the discussions that we have with these sort of things, the sort of fundamental racial dynamic in play in the United States for much of U.S. history is black versus white. So quoting from the Smithsonian, "Despite the ultimate surrender, one of the many bits of Blair Mountain history that continues to stick out is the diversity of the miners' army." And again, this goes to the point that Rachel said, which is that in all of the discussion we've had up to this point, they're really not mentioning the racial identity or ethnicity of people that were participating or killed in action. In 1921, coal company towns were segregated, and Brown v. Board of Education was decades away. However, Wilma Steele, a board member of the West Virginia Mine Wars Museum, says Mattawan, which was the independent town, not the company town, which we talked about earlier in the episode, was one of the only towns in the United States where black and white children, most commonly Polish, Hungarian, and Italian immigrants, went to school together. Other miners were white Appalachian hill folk. Most all were kept apart in order to prevent organization and unionization. It didn't work. Keeney recalls one incident during the mine wars. Black and white miners held cafeteria workers at gunpoint until they were all served food in the same room and refused to be separated for meals. Now, there's a quote from Keeney here. "We don't want to exaggerate it and act like they were holding hands around the campfire, but at the same time, they all understood that if they did not work together, they couldn't be effective. The only way to shut down the mines was to be sure that everybody participated." I will note that there will be a centennial commemorative concert on September 3rd this year in Charleston, West Virginia, and then the UMWA will march 50 miles over the route of the 1921 marchers, ending on Labor Day this year with a rally at the other end. You can visit Blair100.com for more info. And it's also important to remember that the coal strikes in Alabama that we talked about earlier this summer for 2021 are still ongoing, as the Smithsonian piece also notes. In a more direct parallel to the struggles of the Blair Mountain marchers, miners in Alabama are now, again, that's 2021, not 100 years ago, are now in their fifth month of strike as they fight for higher pay. Miners are particularly upset because they took massive pay cuts to save the Warrior Met Coal Company from bankruptcy and have gotten none of the raises and benefits promised for their sacrifice. In 2016, Warrior Met, a global supplier that mines the kind of coal needed for steel production, reached an agreement that included severe cuts to pay, healthcare benefits, time off from work, and more. Braxton Wright, a Warrior Met miner, says morale is on a bit of a roller coaster. The local UMWA holds solidarity meetings and cooks meals for miners, families, and the community each week. Miners are also getting strike pay from the union and are supported by a food pantry. Wright, whose father and grandfather were miners, say striking workers are attacked on the picket lines regularly. They've had five instances in which non-union workers who break picket lines try to ram picket lines with their vehicles. Warrior Met operates today without a contract, even though it has two union coal mines in the region. Wright says they've received a lot of solidarity from other retail, theater, and even media unions, some of whom marched in a picket line with the Alabama miners. The solidarity with unexpected allies may be surprising, but so are environmental concerns the miners have about nearby waterways, which Wright says have been polluted by coal runoff. They fought for a pollution check on the Warrior River. These are not backwoods miners unconcerned by climate change and pollution. I also want to note here again that this is such a point of, you know, solidarity and concern for all of us, especially when you hear that you have the strike breakers adopting the now widely popular tactic borrowed from terrorists overseas and then implemented widely by reactionary forces in the United States, which is to simply drive your truck through people and over them if you don't like what they're doing and want to hurt them. And so this is something that really affects all of us, in addition to, obviously, that we all benefit from the steel that's produced with this coal. So, Rachel, I'm about ready to wrap it up here, but I wanted to get your closing thoughts on whether it's the current situation today or the centennial August 1921, 100 years ago, Battle of Blair Mountain from August 25th to September 2nd.
I definitely wanted to highlight that the Alabama strike is still going and that they do have a strike fund. I'm not entirely sure where that strike fund is located or where you can donate if you feel the need to. I will probably look for that and we can put it in the show notes. I think it's really important to highlight both the cross-racial solidarity and the fact that it really was a class war that the miners were fighting. You don't really hear about class war unless it's kind of like online role play or kind of LARPing. But the fact there actually was a class war that took place in the U.S. And it, even if they weren't completely successful, they have inspired people in the past century to come together and show solidarity for their fellow workers. And I think that's really inspiring and a lesson we can take note of and bring into the present and the future.
All right. Well, Rachel, thank you for coming on this week to talk about the centennial of the Battle of Blair Mountain in 1921.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.